Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 7 of the Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio here in East Nashville, Tennessee. I'm so glad you've chosen to join me once again as we take some deep dives with a cast of wonderful musicians, producers, and engineers that I've managed to track down and speak to about making music, records, and just doing what they do in their lives in music. Don't forget, there's a link to a playlist on Spotify and Apple Music with links to many of the songs we discuss on today's episode. You'll find links to those playlists in the show notes below or at our website. Meanwhile, the show continues to be largely listener-supported. Your help in keeping the show going is always appreciated, and you can do it with a one-time donation or a Patreon subscription, which is a monthly payment of your choice. And when you sign up for Patreon, you get an ad-free version of the show to listen to, as well as getting entered to win a cunning prize pack from our sponsors at the end of the season. Or if you're tight for dough and you still want to help out, you can subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or just by spreading the word, sharing the show, following us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook, and telling all your pals about it. You can get links to all this stuff at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Meanwhile, a huge thanks to the sponsors this season. Please check them out and let them know I sent you. They are Union Tube and Transistor, Spectra 1964, The Deering Banjo Company, Mule Resophonic Guitars, and The Hen House Hang. All right, thanks so much to you for tuning in, and let's get down to it. Howdy, music nerds, and welcome to the show. This is episode number 152, and my guest this week is the unbelievably wicked guitar player and composer Julian Lage. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for returning. If you're a return listener, I sure appreciate you joining me this week. Things are pretty good over this way. I've been finishing a bunch of projects, mostly mixing, I guess, which is so time consuming and oh so fun. I feel like mixing, even more than playing guitar or playing music in general, you really noticeably get better at it every time. Or I do, anyway. I feel like I do. I don't know if I do. I feel like I do. And that's kind of a weird experience because I don't always feel like that when I'm playing an instrument. And I've been mixing records now for 15 years, I guess, and I'm kind of getting dialed in there. Anyway, it's always fun to do. I guess for the most part, I'm mixing projects that I've recorded and or produced and engineered. But sometimes I just get asked in at the last minute to mix something I had nothing to do with up to that point. And that's always an interesting process too, sort of peeling back the layers of other people's work and seeing what's back there. It's kind of cool. So that's me for the next few weeks in between some gigs and some guitar and pedal steel sessions here in Nashville, which I'm always grateful for and enjoy doing. And speaking of mixing, we've announced the Hen House Hang again for 2024 now, which will be in September of 24. But I'm also going to do another one in March that will be just focused on mixing because it's kind of an intense process. And I have no idea if people are going to be interested, but we're putting one on. We'll see what happens. So it's going to be a 2-day thing over the weekend of March 23rd to 24th, 6 people max. And it's just going to be going in deep into the mixing process here at the Hen House. You can get info on that and the full-on Hen House Hang, which, like last year, will be a 3-day event right here at the Hen House, recording with a full band and learning that side of it. So that's in September. The mixing one's in March. And you can get all the info at stevedawson.ca. So please check that out. What else is going on out there? Have you guys heard the new Stones record? It's pretty cool, actually. I dig it. But I have a theory about it that I've brought up to a couple people to mixed reactions, let's say. My theory is that it's not actually Keith Richards playing on the new Stones album. I feel like I know his playing pretty deeply from listening to all the incarnations of the Stones and various Keith solo projects and seeing him play live a number of times. I just don't hear him on that record. I hear someone that sort of sounds like him, but it's so in tune and in time that it kind of rubs me the wrong way. I like my Stones to be greasy and rough around the edges, and this album is not that. They blast the big riffs right at your face, which makes you think you're hearing Keith, but it's all the little nuances and stuff aside from the big riffs that really make me think that it's not him. We'll probably never know. If I'm right, they'll take that secret with them to the grave, I'm sure. But that's my theory, and I'm sticking to it until someone can convince me otherwise. And just an update here on the end of season giveaway. Our good friends at Spectra 1964, who sponsor the show, have jumped into the fray with an offering of a giveaway of their insanely good BBDI. It's a DI for live or recording that's really incredible sounding. I've got a couple here at the studio. I use them a ton, and they're really responsive and cool. So we're going to be giving the BBDI away from Spectra, plus three pedals from Union Tube and Transistor, and probably some other swag from some of the other sponsors, but I don't totally know yet. So the prizes are ramping up. And all you have to do to be eligible is sign up to the Patreon for the show, help us out a bit with our overhead and expenses, and you get in on the prizes. So thanks to our sponsors for that. And specifically, thanks to a couple of new Patreon members this week who were generous enough to support the show, Kenny Schiff and Scott Rempel. Thanks, guys. That's much appreciated. All right, on to this week's show. Julian Lage is truly a guitarist like no other. He's insanely creative, prolific. He has unbelievable technical facility, but also plays with incredible taste and tone and restraint. He grew up around the Bay Area of California and was a child prodigy who started getting noticed when he was just a tiny little kid, like 6 or 7 years old kind of kid. There's a movie about him called Jules at 8, and he played at the Grammys when he was 12, which is pretty nutty. And that's where Gary Burton, the incredible vibraphone player, heard him and asked him to join his band at 12 years old. So Julian ended up doing that and played with Gary for the better part of a decade. But he's also spent time playing and collaborating with people like John Zorn, Nels Klein, Dave Douglas, Charles Lloyd, as well as on the bluegrass side of things with David Grisman and Chris Eldridge from the Punch Brothers. Julian's been releasing solo albums since 2009, and over the last year released a full-length album that's absolutely spectacular called View with a Room, and then some songs that were essentially outtakes from that album but took on kind of a life of their own came out more recently, and that's called The Layers. And man, that is just an incredible album. Go check it out. Julian sort of rekindled my love for jazz guitar. I've sort of lost my interest in modern jazz guitar over the years. There's not a lot coming out that I'm super interested in, aside from maybe like Bill Frisell and John Scofield, stuff like that here and there. But Julian's records, man, they're knocking me out. He has this incredible trio now that I think is one of the great American ensembles, like right up there with the Miles Davis Quintet or the Buckaroos or the Texas Playboys or Keith Jarrett's great bands. I'd put them up there with any of those classic groups. So I would highly recommend all their albums as a trio. Julian's an incredible talent, very thoughtful human and musician. We had a great conversation about all these aspects of his career, and you can keep up with what he's up to over at julianlage.com. And he seems to always be on tour these days, whether it's with the trio or a duo of some sort with somebody or solo shows or whatever he's up to, go see him play. So with that, enjoy my conversation with Julian Lage. Well, thanks for doing this on July 4th, man. I'm Canadian, so it's not like it's not much of a big deal for me.
No, things are quiet here too.
Yeah.
Of course, my pleasure to be with you.
I don't know if I doubt New York goes as nutty as Nashville does, but that's where I am.
Oh, and, you're in Nashville?
Yeah, I'm in East Nashville, and I think you lived close to me, and the only reason I know that is Christian Settlemyer is a good buddy of mine, and I remember him telling me at some point that either you lived in his house or that you were rent, or he'd found you a place to rent or something.
But. Yeah, it was great. We rented he had a place on Granada.
Okay.
That we lived on. I'm sure he still has it.
He does, yeah.
Yeah, but it was lovely. It was like, oh, I send him my regards, please. Next time you speak to him.
I will. I see him quite a bit. He moved here as he moved, like he was living in South End sort of, and then he moved up just a couple blocks away from me here in Five Points, basically. So.
Oh, that's so great. Oh, it's a beautiful area.
It is, yeah. So actually, before we start, I just wanted to say that new Margaret Glaspie single.
Oh, yeah.
Act Natural. That's insane. I just listened to it this morning.
Oh, it's great.
Do you have your mitts on that in some way? Are you playing on it? Are you producing it?
No.
Okay.
I was in the session. I was part of the session just being there. But Wait till you hear the whole record. It's just tremendous. It's the best.
Yeah. Do you play on some of the record, or are you just
No, you're just a fan? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Cool.
Wicked. Maybe we could launch in and talk a bit about the layers.
Sure.
For me, it's a really incredible record, and
thanks.
And I might even be more drawn to it even than what it's sort of spun out of. And I'd like to kind of understand where it came from, and like, I know that it was from the same sessions as View with a Room, and maybe you could just talk a little bit about what separated those tracks out in your mind from them, because like sonically it's sort of like a half acoustic record almost. I don't know if you sort of thought of it that way, or but if you could maybe talk a little bit about the project in general and just sort of like what the hallmarks of those tunes are.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, first of all, for saying that. I'm glad you, that it resonated with you. I like it too. I think it is weirdly quite different for being conceived of as a whole body of music. When I was writing for View with a Room, I think we settled on, I at least historically, I have a propensity for writing a lot of music and then narrowing it down. Mm-hmm. Writing duplicates of songs, or triplicates. Like, these are three ballads that serve a similar function, but maybe have a different feature. And so by the time we went to record, we had whittled it down to 16. And we did the whole record in about 2 days and listened back on the end of the second day. There's one conception that would say, this is a great record, but it's long. It would be come out to about 75 minutes, And for a while I played around with that idea, thinking like, I don't think any of this is extraneous because we've already gone from 35 songs down to 16. So we've cut out a lot.
Okay.
But as we sat with it, it seemed like two narratives presented themselves. The one narrative, it's about these songs, these kind of songs that are relatively short, three, four minutes. And there's kind of a story that's told between the three trio songs.
Yep.
And then the rest are which are with Frizzell. And there's something about the architecture of that music, that's very clear, declarative. Here's the melody, here's the solo, here's the thing, whatever, here's the intro. And what that left were these six songs that were less declarative and maybe a tad more ephemeral, songs that kind of just ooze into being, a song like Mantra or Let Every Room Sing. And I guess the only real thing I remember was thinking that I don't want to utilize those more ephemeral songs as like a release valve for View with a Room.
Okay.
So I didn't want it to feel like song, here's our free piece and here's song. Because I've done that on records, and there's a certain that's a thing, but I felt like, well, that's not quite it for this. So taken as a six piece entity, it has its own conscience. These songs portray a different picture. Like you said, about half acoustic, half electric, totally incidental. That just happened to be what those were, but it was all the same session. So
you said free. Were some of these free improv?
Well, I mean, something like Let Every Room Sing, Mantra, what the written material is, tiny. It's only a few seconds long.
Oh, okay.
So the majority of the piece is all improvised, yeah.
Okay.
Trying to think of another one that's like that. The whole middle of Missing Voices. I mean, again, that's a very short song.
Yeah.
But in the middle, there's this kind of journey that we all go on. So, yeah, I guess from my point of view, I think of them as having a bias towards group, like free improvisation,
mm-hmm.
With these melodies, that kind of get us started.
And when you were doing your composition, which I actually wanted to talk to you about the process of composition and arranging with your trio and all that as well, but did these feel like kind of odd ducks at the time, or was that something that kind of evolved as the process went along?
Yeah, they didn't. The harmonically, melodically, and architecturally, they're relatively similar. The vocabulary is rather holistic, it's, mm-hmm. But isn't it so true though that songs kind of have, they tell, you know, the music tells us what they need. It's not for me to say really. But I do think we all took note of the fact that those six songs, more so than being outliers, were, just had these hard to define, trajectories. Like each song has a beginning, a middle, and an end on the layers, but not in an obvious way. Like even like we were just talking about, where you have three of the pieces on the record are, I think of as free improvisations with these melodies at the beginning and the end. You know, there were other takes of those pieces with different improvisations that didn't at all coalesce in that way.
Right. Yeah, I bet.
So, yeah, so there, absolutely, there's data that you get, I think, only once you've lived through recording it. And then you can go, oh, wow, I thought this was this to, I thought this represented something to that record. In reality, it had a whole life of its own. So
what about a tune like Double Southpaw, which to me seems more composed and arranged?
Yeah, you're right.
Is it, or am I?
No, you're right. No, you're 100% right. That's a tune. You know, it's a lead sheet kind of song. Yeah. I write with pen and paper, pretty religiously. So I think of things in the size of the paper and then the disposition. So, you know, this, all the songs on this record were landscape charts.
Oh, okay.
You know, and when you write, for me, at least writing landscape, yeah, there's a different perception of the architecture, versus a lead sheet. You know, maybe with a landscape, there's a more sense that, okay, this is a journey. 'Cause you see the top left and the bottom right of the page and you can kind of follow this essay, musical essay. And then there are lead sheet style songs, which are usually up, you know, vertical and kind of like you'd see in a fake book. And those are songs to me that look like the way they sound when you look at the paper. And they usually look more comfortable on a vertical piece of paper. Double Southpaw is kind of like that. It's like, I think the structure is A1, A2B, with a little extension. And so I just remember that one laying it out horizontally in landscape and thinking, yeah, this is more of a vertical song, but we'll just try it out, you know?
I love that. That's cool.
It's cool, and it's a bass feature. You know, I don't take a solo on it. It's Ori's feature, so that's, each tune kind of has something distinguishing about it.
Is that something that you bake into the composition end, or is that something that you're playing the tune and Jorge jumps in and you're like, yeah, that's what we're going to do? Or like, where do those decisions get made?
Who knows? I mean, I think it's both. In that case, I remember, you know, for one, it's acoustic and there's no drums. So that suddenly makes it a feature of the bass and the guitar. And since there's so much guitar on the record, I think it organically became a feature for Jorge because Jorge's amazing. And it's, you know, why wouldn't you want to hear him featured? So it's just so I do think there's a fair amount of seeing what the music requires, you know, and that one was kind of like that. However, the more we've played that tune, it does lend itself well to the bass. And it lends itself also to the way the guitar accompanies. I'd rather be the accompanist on that tune from a guitaristic point of view than the soloist necessarily. Except when we play it as a trio, and then I think the bass solo makes less sense. So, you know, things like that.
So is the fact that it came out as a duo with you and bass, was that a decision that you made as a producer, just saying like, we're going to have this moment where the drums split, or like if you've been doing the tune as a trio as well, like what made you say, well, let's do this one as a duo?
We had tried it quartet with Bill in rehearsal. Mm-hmm. We tried it trio. And then Jorge and I played a lot of that music duo. Probably the most of that music was all rehearsed with just me and Jorge.
Okay.
Margaret produced the record, you know, and very traditionally, like I played the guitar on it and I wrote the songs, but a lot of those decisions were, I like not being so, I phrase it in the positive. I love being able to just show up and play and not have to keep zooming out to go, is this right? Or is this relevant? So at some point, presumably, we played a duo as we were rehearsing and Margaret probably said, sounds great. And Dave King, our drummer, said, sounds great.
He probably wanted a coffee at that point in the day.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows?
So I don't have the credits for this. So Margaret is the producer of both records then, View with the Room.
Yeah.
And
she did Squint as well.
Okay.
The previous record we did for Blue Note.
How's that working with your wife in the studio? Pretty great. It's obviously working for you.
Well, I can't speak for anyone else's relationship, you know, so I don't know. But Margaret's Margaret Glaspie. You know, she's an incredible force of nature creatively. And so
yes, she is.
It's a privilege. And she's not just my producer. She's producing, you know, Frizzell and Dave and Jorge and all of us. So her ability to look at the music and be unimpressed by maybe any window dressings is great, because I think at the end of the day, she's one of the great storytellers. And if the songs are telling a story or feel evocative, then we're on the right track. And if we're getting into the weeds about something that's cool but not the point, she's very comfortable saying that's not the point, you know, try this mm-hmm. or try that. So it's fabulous. I mean, we've been lucky though, you know, we've been musical partners in crime for 15 years, better part of 15 years. So that's definitely at the root of our connection.
That makes a huge difference when you know somebody's music that deeply and you've got that musical connection that goes back. It's easier to communicate in the studio, I think.
I think so. I feel very privileged to work with her.
Yeah, cool. Both these two records are essentially your current trio, which I want to talk about, like the functionality of the trio as a concept, but it's like the trio plus Frizzell. And I know you've kind of worked with him quite a bit now over the years. Mm. And I guess with him being back in New York, you've probably
seen
him fairly often. Tell me about how that came about. Was that like a suggestion by somebody, or did it just happen naturally? Or did he just show up at the studio and say, okay, I'm here.
I'm here.
Yeah.
It started with a discussion with Bill. I had been thinking about how to expand the orchestration of the band, the trio, without it really leaving the intimacy of the trio. And Frizzell is the perfect choice, you know, as someone who is empathetic, masterful, can jump into a scenario and contribute, but not take away attention from kind of the pillars of the music.
Yeah.
And so when he and I spoke about it, I was rather apologetic, because I said, you know, Bill, this is crazy. Like, yeah, we've been playing a lot of duo together, a lot of stuff, a lot of Zorn records. Myself and Bill and Gion Reilly, we have a trio plays. I think we made six or so records of that in the last couple of years. We've played in Charles Lloyd's band together. We've played a lot, you know, and we both come from Jim Hall as far as kind of a mentor figure. So I was saying that to Bill early on. I said, I want you to be a part of this, but I feel weird because it's not a duo record. We're not really sparring partners. And he was, much to my relief, very understanding. He said, no, I don't think we're going to play Autumn Leaves duo or do our thing. It's your record and I'm going to play rhythm, basically. And I was like, that is what I'm looking for. And so he said, great, I'll bring, you know, a telly, a baritone, a jazz master, a J45, and all these different guitars. And we'll kind of set up a sonic realm so you can just kind of do what you do and I'll fill it out. And that's no small feat. It's incredible. So it started with that conversation. And then I had been writing with him in mind. And then we just rehearsed it the day before we recorded it. Mm-hmm. And it was at that time that we kind of dialed in which guitars made sense, where he enters, where he's out, you know, or just orchestration stuff, arranging stuff. And also which songs he wouldn't play on. Like those three trio pieces where his omission is as much a sign of his musicality as the tunes where he's playing, because he said, no, I think this only clutters it. You got it. Okay, cool. And then the next one would be like, no, I think I could add something with baritone, for example, or whatever it might be. So it was a dialogue.
Did that need much input from you or Margaret, or was he pretty much right on the money?
No, he's right on the money.
He knows what he's doing, that guy.
He's the baddest. Bill Frizzell's the baddest. He knew exactly. And it takes shape in the studio, as you know well. It's like it's kind of like the theme of our conversation today is that I'm noticing is you take your cues from the situation, you know, not from a necessarily premeditated agenda. It's good to have an agenda, but it's also, at least with this record, you go, wow, the sum of the parts is something far greater than my imagination can really process.
Yeah.
And it's best that I let, you know, relinquish to that, you know, because Bill would come up with things that I wouldn't have thought of at all, And I think that's why you call Bill Frisell. If I could think of it, I would do it myself. So it's a celebration of surprise. It's a celebration of the unknown. And I'm glad it was captured on tape.
Yeah, me too. For me, like he embodies this thing where, like, I'm a guitar player as well, and I had sort of tuned out guitar-based jazz for whatever that thing is. I kind of lost interest in it, and any jazz that I was listening to wasn't really featuring the guitar for quite a while. And then, sure, you know, my interest in like modern jazz kind of waned and stuff until I heard the Frisell record that like freaked my mind out was the Tales from the Far Side. I don't know if you know that record, but there's no drums or bass. It's just him, the horn players and stuff. And, or maybe there is a bass player. I can't remember, but there's no drums. It's like a very unique, crazy record.
Yeah.
And that's when I kind of realized like, oh, I think the idea of a jazz guitarist is coming back into my interest realm. and then I heard your records and I had a similar kind of feel. For you, was he somebody that was like an influence? Like I know you're much younger than him, so you would have been coming up through the ranks as he was already very established and had a huge catalog already. But was that a big thing for you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't remember ever a time in life of where at any age where I wasn't aware of Bill Frisell. You know, it's like knowing who that George Washington was the first president. You just kind of know these, you know what I mean? Oh, yeah, I guess. And so there was a period where I was very aware of Bill, but I hadn't done the deep dive, you know, when I was really little, because I was so on it. I was very obsessive about Jim Hall. And then, you know, quickly I became aware of Bill's actual, not only playing, but writing, you know, one of the great composers of our time, anytime. And then we became friends and then we started playing together. So there's something kind of surreal about it, you know? But I really hear you. I am a jazz guitar nerd and I have been since I was young. And I have so much, I just have a lot of empathy for exactly what you said, which is, jazz guitar centered music it's like any kind of niche thing. It's hard to put all your eggs in that basket. Cause at the end of the day, it's forget the guitar, forget that it's jazz. Are you connecting with the music? You know, the history of jazz guitar is so interesting because it's always been, kind of reflective, at least in jazz, of technological advancements. You know, it wasn't always jazz guitar, it was banjo, it was tenor banjo in the early Dixieland bands. And then the guitar became more popular, and that was in the band. And then electric guitar became popular.
Then electricity came along. Yeah.
Like, exactly. And so it kind of marks the history of just culture. You know, guitar has an interesting way of reflecting culture at different areas, spots, like any instrument, but I just happen to know more about, or take more of an interest in guitar, I guess. I'm sure the same could be said for drums and piano and horns and other instruments and obviously singing, but so the guitar is really, I do feel like it's what the person is saying, and that's exciting. And I was just listening to Jimmy Bryant the other day again, who I think is the greatest. And you know, just being struck by like what a beautiful convergence of technology.
Yep.
You know, he's playing he and Leo are kind of working side by side in late 40s, early 50s, kind of focusing on the quality of the telly, and he's using it and he's on the radio and all these, they're using the Tweed amps at the time and yada, yada, yada. And the language is this kind of Southern bebop country thing. Right. And it's in, you know, the same time that bluegrass and bebop are both kind of thriving. Then a few years later, you have someone like Jimmy Bryant, and it carries us through many decades of that. Anyway, I just heard that and thought, wow, what a beautiful portrait of a culture, you know. And when I hear him play guitar, I hear culture. I don't hear that's jazz guitar music. So I think the best hope is that things converge in such a way that you just experience a message, and hopefully that resonates.
I love that.
At this point in the show, I'd like to thank our amazing sponsors for the season. We couldn't do it without their support, and this year they are Mule Resophonics. Swing wider for inspiration with Mule Resophonic guitars. These are Resophonic guitars built for acoustic guitar players. Not just blues guitars, not just slide guitars. You don't need to play them in open tunings. They're set up with normal acoustic guitar action, and they have some of the best feeling necks in the game. Trust me, they're wicked. These musical tools wake up your ear and influence your playing towards uncharted musical realms. Check out the current lineup of guitars at the Mule Store at MuleResophonic.com. Thanks to Deering. Deering Banjos makes some of the finest instruments out there these days and caters to all levels as well. If you're just getting into the banjo, they offer their incredible Good Time series, which are high-quality instruments at lower prices. Deering Banjos are all made in the USA, and their website also features some incredible info on their products and just general banjo information. And now Deering is also making Pro Pick finger picks and thumb picks, and that's exciting because I've been using those finger picks for years. They make these cool ones with the fingertips missing, and I love those. They're the best. You can get info on the banjos and the finger picks over at DeeringBanjos.com. Thanks to Spectra 1964. For over 50 years, Spectra 1964 has established a reputation of creating some of the most innovative recording equipment on the market today. Their consoles and preamps were behind the sound of so many great American studios of the 1960s through to today. Spectra 1964 continues the legacy of providing incredible recording products for the home or professional studio. Check them out at Spectra1964.com. Union Tube and Transistor. Union is known for guitar effects pedals with a focus on quality and simplicity. They build durable, repairable products that sound amazing both on stage and in the studio. Their fuzz effects and compression pedals are insanely cool. I use the Sonebender Fuzz, the Moore pedal, the Lab, and the Swindle Overdrive all the time in sessions and live on stage. You can find out more about them at uniontone.com. And finally, the Henhouse Hang is a 3-day immersive recording experience at the Henhouse Studio in East Nashville with me, Steve Dawson. It'll be in September 2023 and then upcoming again in September of 2024. Join us for a musical learning experience like no other. We'll show you the ropes of recording roots in Americana music by bringing you in on a real session with real musicians working on real songs from the ground up. You can get all the info at stevedawson.ca. Just follow the links on the front page to the Henhouse Hang. All right then, let's get back to the show. Jimmy Bryant sort of opens up this whole thing that I wanted to talk to you about too, which is like your current sound, and he was a telly player, and I know that you primarily these days play the telly. I don't know if that's correct or not, but
absolutely.
Both these records seem almost completely telly to me, but is that true?
It's funny. Those two records are all Callings guitars. I'm not playing any telly on those records, but to tour those for that record, I play a lot more telly these days, mostly because it's a little easier to transport. Less nervous about it, all the electric of me is this Callings 470 JL. It's a signature guitar that we made together, and it's funny because it to me it's all neck pickup, and it's all Ron Ellis Ellisonic pickups, which are based on the design of a Dynasonic, like an old Gretsch, but improved in many ways. And I do have a feeling that in a studio, that guitar captures what a telly sounds like live.
Okay.
Which is a weird thing to say, but it's like a translation issue. Often when I'm in the studio with a telly, I felt it doesn't sound like a telly as much. Whatever,
weird.
To me, I just kind of go, oh, I miss that thing that I feel when I'm on stage with it. So anyway, that guitar, its bass line is a great kind of primitive electric sound.
Are you using flatwounds on it? It sounds flatwound.
Not at that time. I use flatwounds on a telly now.
Yeah.
It's like a snake eating its own tail. I mostly use a telly with flatwounds now to sound like the 470 with round wound sounded in the studio. And the reason I used that was because it sounded like my telly sounded before. So, we're talking nuances, but it's roughly the same sonic profile. I mean, both guitars do it. Just in different ways.
And what about amps for you? Because like there is such a beautiful line that you hit with like there is that breakup that for me just makes things sound so organic and wicked. Like I love the tone that you're getting. So that's the Callings. And what are you using? You must be using low powered, like are you using tweeds or something to get that little edge of breakup?
Yeah, my amp for many years has been by a gentleman named Mike Moody. Has a company called Magic Amplifiers, and he makes just great amps in the kind of the style of our favorite old amps. The one I use is a Vibro Deluxe. It's like a black panel deluxe, you know, okay, pretty much to spec. That's how the record was recorded. Then we went back and reamped it through a, I forget the year, 58, 59 Tweed Champ. We have a couple at home. And so anytime your breakup, it's just that's blended into the deluxe. So it's basically a deluxe and a champ.
Oh, so the deluxe you're using for the super clean, and then the champ is giving you a little bit of gnarl.
It's, and it's the amount of champ is very light. You know, yeah, it's 10, 15% of that. And it's not even okay, like a driven champ. It's only on, it's actually, it's almost, I often think about what, when I'm looking for crunch, I sometimes have to recalibrate and remember that, excuse me, a mid-range boost in the right amount of compression can give the same impact, mm-hmm, as actual grit. And I've been disappointed when I've tried overdrive pedals or things that are really great in and of themselves, but I kind of realize it's not actually the grit that I want, it's just the volatility.
Yeah.
And I think compression and mid-range are what the champ adds. And then you put that in, surround it with the deluxe sound, and then you have, you know, that record is also both those records were recorded in one room with no headphones, you know, and really no, very little baffling. So it's tons of bleed. So I think some of the volatility of the sound is that you're hearing the guitar through the drums, you know, you're hearing my guitar through Frizzell's sound or through the bass. So I use this a couple pedals. I love this one pedal in particular. It's called a Big One. B1G is how it's called. And it's kind of like an API preamp. So it hits the front end of the amp just a little harder. It's just a boost.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's always volatility. You know, I am such an acoustic guitar player, really. Like, that's, I think, probably my most comfortable place. But
really?
Totally. I mean, that's the profile I have in mind for volatility. You know, you can like drive an acoustic, you play harder, and the top can, sometimes it just collapses, sometimes it kind of growls. But that, this notion that you're dealing with a chamber, like an actual chamber of this acoustic box, and the pressure is shifting and it informs how you play, is what I'm looking for with an amp. The trouble is I don't play very loud. And if I did, it would probably make this easier because you get volatility sooner. For us, it's always the trick of how do you say, because I'm volatile when you're very quiet. Right. I mean, the amp, the deluxe is on like 2.
Okay.
So it's not loud music because I have to be quiet enough to hear the bass acoustically.
Of course. Yeah. So you're not using monitors then? You're not getting bass in the monitor or anything like that?
No,
that's cool.
Not ever.
What about acoustic when you play live? Do you plug those in or do you just play into a mic?
No, just play into a mic.
And no monitoring back of that?
No. No.
Well, so how does your drummer hear you?
Yeah, I don't know. We don't play very loud, you know. I mean,
but he's not getting any of you in a wedge or something?
No.
Whoa, man, that's crazy.
I play loud. You know, when I play acoustic, I'm not a light player per se, comparatively. I mean, and the types of guitars I like to play acoustically are usually mahogany, and they're kind of bitey. You know, there's kind of a snarl. So, but decibel level is really a part of it. If you're not playing loud, I mean, we did these videos for The Layers where we played the songs, Double Southpaw, and then we did The Layers, that song, and, you know, we're just set up closely, no monitors. I mean, he's barely touching the drums, Dave, he seems to hear me fine.
But like at gigs too?
Yeah.
Okay.
But also keep in mind though, if we're at a gig, right, and there's a big PA and you're hearing it in the room, you know, so it's, I think the notion that it has to be directional in order for it to be to register is maybe something we relinquish. You know, we're in a room and our sounds are bouncing around. It's kind of blurry, but we can see each other and it's fine. You know, there is, I'm not saying it couldn't be more refined, but.
Well, it doesn't need to be more refined. I'm just fascinated with the whole idea.
No, now that you say that, I think how weird that is, but I don't play acoustically a lot live, you know, but we've done them for recordings, and, but guitars travel, mid-range travels, you know, you can kind of,
yeah.
And it's, if you don't have anything around you, I mean, if it was, God, if it was a quartet or a quintet or something, and there were horns, you definitely need some support.
Something. But, yeah.
But drums are kind of woody and papery, and the bass isn't loud, and the guitar is very pointy. So yeah, so I don't know. Somehow it works.
That's cool. So I love getting into the setup, like the kind of the nerdy deets of the sessions. So yeah. for the last two records that obviously were done at the same time in the same place, were you in New York or were you in Nashville? I know you've done stuff at Sound Emporium.
We did a record at Sound Emporium. Those records, View with Rome and The Layers, were made in Brooklyn and at a studio called The Bridge in Williamsburg. Great studio.
And so you're all set up in one room. Yeah. Did you put were the amps in the room with you? I'd imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. Just behind us. We're set up in like a circle, you know, with a bunch of mics, tons of bleed.
Right.
My Lord.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's something. It has a certain sound, which I think is good.
It sure does. It's got it's one of the most like intimate, but also like really deep, like the depth. Mm. I mean, like the physical depth of the sound is like really remarkable.
That's Mark Goodell. I mean, our engineer Mark is very special, very, very special. And he's a genius. He really just is. And so he understands the meaning of the music and how that translates to his own capabilities, and he marries the two. I mean, that's we've long had a sense though that there needn't be any kind of puritanical agenda. Like it's not good because it's intimate, or it's not good because it's raw, or it's because it felt. It's a little bit of like, who cares? It either comes out of the speaker, so moves you, or it doesn't. And that particular setup on that record succeeded, I think, in that respect, where at least to me, I hear it and I go, yeah, that's what we're going for. We just made a record a month ago and it was wildly different. Everyone was in booths and it was more musicians and that sounds great too. So it's, I think it just depends on the music, really.
Could we talk a little bit about your trio? So you've worked with other trios, but this one to me, like I always think of great bands in like the history of American recorded music, and there's certain bands that for me like really feel incredible, like sort of like the Stones do in a way, but also like the big ones for me would be like Buck Owens and the Buckaroos, like that band, or Bob Wills, or like Coltrane's some of Coltrane's stuff, like and for me your trio sort of has that thing of like creativity and like clearly has played a shit ton of gigs together.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Can you tell me a bit about how you started playing with these guys, how long you've known them, what it feels to you that's special about this particular trio?
Well, I have to first say thank you for your kindness. I love this band. Jorge Roeder and I go back probably 15 years or so of playing together in a band of mine from back when I was in college. We made a couple records, the Julian Lage group. But then he joined Gary Burton's band when I was, so we were in Gary's band together. Then we were both in Nels Klein's band together.
Duo
touring. And then we were in John Zorn's New Masonic Quartet together. So Jorge and I are, and we've played.
Are you
live.
The same age?
No.
Roughly?
He's just maybe, I'd say 7 or 8 years older.
Okay.
Is that right? I think so.
But you didn't grow up together, obviously.
We didn't grow up together, no. But yeah. we've been playing together a long time, and we're I feel very fortunate that we're kind of a team that has had the privilege of playing a lot of different music together. So it's not just the show. It's like we're just musicians, you know, and we're soulmates on some level, and that's means everything to me, you know, to share that with Jorge. So the trio is that's he and I share the longest relationship in this band. Dave King is someone
Bad
I've been
Plus.
Bad Plus, his group, yeah. Bad Plus, and the Trucking Company, and excuse me, all these other bands he's been a part of, are things that are bands I've been a fan of for as long, even mm-hmm. longer, you know, the last 20, 25 years. We started playing together in the last, I don't know, sometime in the last decade. Yeah. Hit it off famously from the start. And he's become this absolute force of nature, extension of, I think, what Jorge and I share. Plus, I think the combination of Jorge and I plus Dave equals something that is its own, has its own rhythm, that has its own heartbeat. And I think that's what we hear in the trio when we play. We go, wow, this is kind of the convergence of all these relationships, you know? And just on a musical level, both Jorge and Dave are tremendous, you know, they're masterful on their respective instruments. They're the greatest. And, so it's very inspiring to play with them. And, we're lucky that we get to play together and to have made these records together. I mean, it's a real group effort.
Do you find that it influences the way that you compose? Like, are you writing yeah. music with those guys in particular in mind?
Absolutely. I mean, down to the, what tempos do they like to play? What feels do they like to play? What would push them to something that I know they do, but maybe we don't do a lot. 100%. The music's only there for them. You know, it's not like here are the tunes. Let me see who I can get to play them. It's like it's purely yeah. for them.
Yeah.
Which is so inspiring. You know, it's just so inspiring to have that opportunity.
And you've had yeah. other trios too, like with Kenny Wallace, and I don't remember yeah. who the bass player was, but that was a cool trio too. Like, how does it work for you, like as a band leader and a arranger with like working with different people? Like, what's the process of figuring out who you're going to be playing with? Or does it just kind of happen because so-and-so is available and then it really clicks?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you know this dance very well, that it's about relationships, you know, yep. and if we're fortunate enough to be around the people we have good relationships with, then the details of how to navigate the music often are supported. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's not like, how do I get this person to do what I want? It's not really. So the trio with Kenny Wallace and Scott Colley, for example, is tremendous, has its completely different heartbeat yeah. and it moves differently. And hopefully the music supports it. There was a period where it was with Eric Dube, incredible drummer, Eric Dube, and then Jorge Roeder. That was fantastic. There's a version with Joey Barron and
oh, really?
Jorge. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
That's completely different. It's mostly improvised music. So these are all people that I love. So there's, I'd much rather play something easier, so to speak, that supports the relationships than kind of impose any compositional agenda. Mm-hmm. I don't care. I don't, whatever everyone sounds right. great playing, we should do. The yeah, beauty yeah. of playing with Dave and Jorge is I do feel I think it's the convergence of all the agendas. You know, we could go play free. It'd be great. We also have a shared compositional vocabulary, having made several records together, and that comes to life in a very specific way when we play it. So it definitely is the most complete picture musically of what I'm up to. But it's friendships. I know that sounds cliche, but it really
no,
just play with
yeah.
your friends, play with your friends, like playing with people who you'd be thrilled to play with no matter what the music is. That's kind of been my mantra, and I've been very lucky to do that.
That's a good mantra. I dig it.
Yeah, thanks.
When you like compose a piece and you bring it yeah. to the guys and you decide to make a record, yeah. how much do you work the stuff out? How much is it arranged? Do you like to road work stuff before you go into the studio?
Or ideally,
is it kind of like
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Ideally, if we can play a tour or at least a couple shows of music, it's great just to get proportions in our heads. Like, oh, this section needs a longer bridge, or this needs,
yeah,
you don't need this third section. You know, anything that maybe made sense in isolation gets aired out if we get to play a show. One of those crazy virtues of the world. You just self-reflect in a different way. And you go, whoa, no, this is way too slow. We need to speed this up because we're, you know.
Yeah.
But it's, there's, you know, there's sheets of paper. No, nothing's longer than a page, maybe two, okay, if it's needed. But so we're not talking about compositions that are super dense. They're right. Comparatively, you know, they're.
Do you write sketches of bass lines and things, or do you just leave that open? You just give Jorge a chord chart kind of thing.
It's chord chart, melody chart. We all have the same score, so to speak.
Okay. Yeah.
But I think the nature of our ensemble is that we like arranging and improvising and leaving room. So it's the hardest thing, like they say, is to put the pencil down, you know, because you can keep writing and as long, you know, what my friend was saying about some of my tunes, he was playing them, and he said, it's weird. It's like they tend to be simple, but there'll be this one detail that if you miss it, you kind of blow the whole thing. I said, I think that's true, you know? So there's a design element that says, like, this is familiar, but this one thing we should tend to. It could be a change in tempo. It could be the type of improvising. I mean, that's the other thing. I think any song, it's not a given that a song has one way to solo on it. Mm-hmm. So I think part of part of navigating the music when it's brand new is saying, okay, when we get to the blowing, is it a free for all? Is it more of guitar led? Is it more motivic development? Is it more harmonic? Is it more about reharmonization? Is it more of a rhythmic study? So
does that get discussed, or do you okay, yeah.
We talk about it. You know, I mean, you have to play it first, I think, then you know whether there's a discussion to be had or not. But at the end of the day, it's an improvising ensemble. And I do think improvising ensembles, the ones I love, they take a lot of care to understand what the kind of protocol is. It's not just write the song, then play over changes, and then end the song. And there's nothing wrong with that. But at this point in history, there's been enough, you know, you take the Keith Jarrett Quartet and you listen to them playing anything, but, you know, a song like The Wind Up, you know, or My Song. What I'm struck with when I hear that is these are songs that could have been interpreted so many ways, but they're coming at them with a freedom, and that combined with the melodicism and the clarity of architecture is really this new alchemy. Mm-hmm. So I think any song is a matter of alchemy. It's the song plus the disposition of the band, plus the, frankly, the interpretation. The classical musicians are all, we understand that you interpret Bach or you interpret Chopin. You don't just play the dots, you know, but the interpretation is our whole business too. You know, would this song benefit from a solo that's not so slick? You know, maybe it's more you stumbling and there's a vulnerability. Sometimes songs really benefit from much longer solos. I remember when I was in Charles Lloyd's band more regularly, we were playing a lot, and he got his one critique of me that, at least that he verbalized, was so fantastic, where he said, you're not playing long enough. And I kind of mistakenly thought it was a compliment, you know, like, kind of like, no, I'm cool. Thank you, though. I'm glad you like what I would. And he's like, no, really, we need you to, playing a solo that's only a couple minutes is very, it's great that you can do it, but you're not breaking through that kind of other transcendent thing that only happens when you play long enough.
Whoa.
I thought, right, that's part of that's the interpretation, you know, it's own genre, long form development. It's the difference between a novel and a short story. And if you're out there to put out novels, you better write a novel, you know? So I just think those things are fascinating. And anyway, so it's not to take us off topic from your question, but I do think in a way it's saying that those decisions are made collectively, and they're made from an improvising and compositional point of view simultaneously.
I understand. That's cool.
It's fun.
What is your composition process? Like, I'm sure it's different and it probably varies a lot, as does anybody's, but do you have a general way of working? Like, do you hear something in your head and write down the changes and the notes, or are you sitting there on the guitar farting around until something sounds wicked and then you start like kind of writing it down, or like how do you write?
Well, it's God, I like to record myself improvising a lot. And then if there, I often will transcribe things that I think sounded good and then maybe build a piece from that or modify it. I felt it was so taboo to do that for a long time. I thought, well, no. Once you, if you improvise it, you can't write it down. I don't know what, why I had held that notion to be true, but for me, that's in general a good way to start. Play the guitar, record it. If something happens enticing, get to know it. You know, go, well, why did I like that? Well, maybe I liked it because I like that key, or I like that tempo, or this one thing is really cool. And what if? And then the question, it's a series of, you know, inquiries. What would come next if this part is the thing? You know, what would, if that's the riff, what does it need? Well, maybe it could use a bridge. Okay, here's a few different bridges. I've said it before, and so forgive me for repeating myself. But years ago, I remember asking, it's just so profound. I asked Chick Corea once, we were at a festival together, and I knew him somewhat well, but we were around each other a lot, especially because I played so much with Gary Burton. Played so much together. But I got up the nerve to ask Chick if he had any composition advice. I said, do you have any advice for a composer? And he said, yes, which is the perfect answer. You want to hear someone say, I know exactly what to tell you. I mean, that alone, I was just like, you don't even have to say anything else. I'm just glad
exactly.
Someone knows.
Just leave it there.
Glad you know what you're doing, because I don't get it. I don't get how to do this for myself. He said, real simple thing. If you have a song you're working on and there's half a dozen ways to write the song, in other words, you have like a theme and a chord progression, or just a theme or just a chord progression, and it occurs to you that it could be a ballad, or it could be a blues, or you could lengthen and make it a 32 bar standard style song, or it's a finger picking song, whatever might occur to you. He said, write each of those versions and pick your favorite out of the versions. And what was so powerful to me about that was I was doing the opposite. I would take a song, consider a way it could go, and say, well, no, I need to write this song. So I can't have six things started. And then once I started doing what he said, I thought, well, I'll write the blues version. Maybe the blues version doesn't have a motivic development, but we just kind of snap it into a 12-bar grid. You know, I say that in, you know, casually, like if there's, it's, but let's say we just roughly kind of are kind of rough around the edge. Okay, put this here, add this. That's your theme for the one and the four chord. What do you do with the five chord? Okay. It's very helpful to get kind of get that out of your system and then go back and say, now I'm going to write the gorgeous lament, you know, singer-songwriter version of this. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, a lot of these things that I was talking about of improvising and writing them down is getting them on paper and then moving them around to make different versions. Cool. So a lot of the songs that are on these records we're talking about today have so many iterations. I mean, those just happen to be the renditions we put on a record, but they're,
do you ever go crazy? Like, do you ever just like drive yourself nuts by like the endless opportunity or the endless like potential directions you could go with something?
No, I'm not that smart. I mean, there are people who have that kind of like Mozart brain where they can find, you know, endless possibility. It's funny. What I found is it's usually doesn't, my experience isn't that it's endless. It's usually that there's a few itches that are trying to be scratched at any given time musically. And one song, any one song could do it. There's a song on this record that we just made where, you know, for a long time, for like a year and a half, I've been working on this song. And for a long time, it was, the whole premise of the song was that it was kind of like a Roy Orbison feel, like a 4/4, kind of like Crying or Love Hurts, or these covers that of his I love. Yeah. I was trying to write my own version of it. And for about a year, that's how I viewed it. I kept tweaking the notes, kind of, well, now this phrase sounds rushed when it's at this tempo, but this tempo is the right tempo for that feel. Wow. I would add sections, take it away. And then, you know, 2 weeks before the session, I said, well, what if it's a waltz? What if I just give that up? And all of a sudden I thought, this is a great jazz waltz. And then the night before the session, I said, it's not a, that's works, but what if it were like a Aretha Franklin kind of 6/8, like a slow gospel 6/8. And that was my favorite version of it. But if you heard all three versions, they would sound like completely different songs.
Yeah.
But that door is always open to, I try to be aware that it's always open, that you can, you have a lot of parameters at play with a song. It's not just, I think sometimes there's a cultural notion that a great song is a great song is a great song. And I think there's a lot of subjectivity. It's all material is magnificent. It's part of the glory of nature and music and vibration. Okay. And so then what you do with it is really, you're trying to get to know the context where in which it shines to you. Tempo, phrasing, volume level, orchestration, timbre, all these other things are very much part of the composition. And I for many years didn't believe that. You know, I thought, no, it's empirically satisfying because of these proportions. And I'm coming to appreciate that there's so much incomplete music I've written, incomplete by my standards, that I do try it on a different guitar and suddenly I don't have the same works. Issues with it. And kind of go, and that's okay. It's okay that it can be easy. You know, it can be okay to not struggle. And so I'm kind of learning that as a composer.
Very interesting. Can you tell me a bit about playing with Gary Burton? Like you mentioned some of the other people that you've had a chance to play with. I would love to just hear about some of your experiences there and maybe, you know, like any interesting things that you learned from him as a band leader or a composer. Like what an incredible experience.
Yeah, right? I mean, Gary Burton is a legend, a true, true legend. And there's not really any, there are no bounds to his influence on me, or I think the culture at large. I mean, apart from being, you know, the leading proponent of, you know, master player of the vibraphone, he is also one of the greatest band leaders, one of the great mentors, one of the great educators, one of the most fearless conceptual artists. I mean, if you look at his catalog, one of the things that I, in answer to your question, that I feel like I've learned from Gary is that he didn't ever seem to be gripping onto a single identity. You know, he, much the way we think of someone like Frizzell or someone, you know, who's so true to themselves that really the excitement becomes, what other context can I hear them in? And how does that shape and inform them?
I always loved that country record that he did in the late 60s, the Tennessee Firebird. It's so happening.
It's amazing, you know?
Yeah.
And, but he would do that. And then within a matter of years, he was doing a tango record with Astor Piazzolla.
Totally.
And then he was on all the Joao Gilberto stuff with Stan Getz. And then, you know, really driving kind of jazz stuff. And then his own band, Original Quartet, which was in kind of the earliest stages of fusion, you know, with electric rock guitar. And,
yeah.
And I mean, it's just profound. So I think I look to Gary as someone who was so, embodies so much trust that if you come to the art and you take chances and you play, that you utilize your mastery and your skills that you develop in service of playing, that you can open new doors. And I think that's one of the beautiful enigmas of Gary, is for as fluid and effortless and kind of rolling with it as Gary can be as a conceptual artist, he's also the highest level virtuoso. And I think,
right.
I think virtuosity, culturally speaking, it's a mixed bag. Sometimes it's conflated with tastelessness or one dimensionality. But I think true virtuosos, I think there is it's mastery that allows for liberation, but it kind of doesn't, the mastery doesn't really kick in unless you've used it for something beyond yourself. And I think that's why when you hear Rubinstein or Martha Argerich or Heifetz or any of these, you know, the great, great, greats, you know, they almost disappear. They're so masterful that they vanish and all that's left are the embers of the music.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gary, that's always been a thing I think I've pursued of, let me try to do any homework I can so that I'm available to what's going on actually, rather than getting caught up at the start line, you know, with abilities or concern about, I don't know enough. You know, I do feel.
Were you a little bit terrified when you first started playing with him?
Not at all.
Okay.
I mean, not at all. When I first started playing with him, I thought, God, I sound great when I play with him. Like that's what that's what great players
that's awesome.
Do. You know?
Yeah.
You kind of, it's like being around anyone who's great at their job. It can raise your stock.
Yeah.
So no. And also keep in mind, Gary was I think our relationship is influenced by the fact that he was kind of a prodigious person as a young person, you know, when he was a child. Right. I mean, he came out of vaudeville and it was a family situation.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
It was a very different thing. But even when he was in his teens, you know, he was, you know, Chet Atkins gave him kind of his first big break and he moved to Nashville and he was working with Hank Garland. But the point being, I think there's a generosity of spirit he always afforded me. It wasn't like, keep up with me, kid. It was kind of like, I'm you, but at a different stage and it's all cool. And you too are invited to be this good. You know, that was the sentiment I got from him. But I think anyone who knows Gary knows that about him, that he's, you know, here's this pillar of conceptual art and music, but he didn't do it by being a composer, which is kind of rare. The tunes he's written are incredible, but Gary throughout his whole career collected songs from Chick or Pat or Steve Swallow or Carla or Keith or Ralph Towner. You know, so he's almost has the disposition of a great producer, and great producers often make the musicians feel their best and make them feel comfortable.
That's huge.
Yeah. It's not like he had a complex about his thing and you had to get on board with it. It wasn't, it's not even his vibe, you know? Anyway, Gary's tremendous. Gary's the best.
That's amazing. So you played with him for how many years?
Very solidly from when I was 12 until I was about 22.
You were playing with him when you were 12?
Yeah, I know. I started very young with him.
That's bonkers. That's like, I don't even want to open that can of worms about like your early years, but like, how does a 12-year-old end up getting a gig with Gary Burton in a nutshell?
In a nutshell? Well, I don't know. I mean, when I was a kid, they made this movie about me called Jules at Eight. It was this wonderful director. And it was a college project. It was a senior year at Stanford. Mark Becker is the director. It's a funny movie because I was 7 years old in it, and they found me because he was in the Bay Area. I was in the Bay Area. He contacted my parents and said, I'm just looking for a subject. And we've heard that your son plays music. And my parents and I turned it down. And he came back 6 months later. Because we thought, you have to keep in mind, it wasn't like I was playing, but I wasn't forging a career. I was just a kid who happened to play a lot of guitar. So he came back and said, no, I'd like to do this. And here I said, I'll do it. So if you ever saw the movie, I don't really play guitar. And I mean, there's a couple scenes where I'm practicing, but it's not an exhibition of my abilities. For whatever reason, which I think is kind of cool. It's just kind of about a kid. You know, when I see it, I go, all right, I know that kid. that got on PBS and that twice a year or so they would play it. Somebody at the Grammys saw that and they were putting together a kid band for the TV show. And they called us and said, we saw this thing. And at this point now, I'm 12 years old. I'm not 7 years old. And I had been playing more professionally. And I did it. I played on TV. And anyway, Gary Burton was in the audience because he was up for a Grammy that year with Chick.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he wrote me a letter, old fashioned, and said, I saw you and I was impressed. And would you play at the TED conference with me? And this was before the TED conference was always a big thing, but not. It was originally run by the guy who started Richard Saul Wurman. It wasn't on YouTube. It wasn't podcasts. It was really a meeting of the minds in this convention center in Monterey, California. And he said, they're doing one of the themes this year is intergenerational, you know, something or other. Would you basically be my younger counterpart? Like, we'll put on a presentation. And so I said, yeah, it was not far from where I grew up and my parents. I went, I played one set with him. It was great. He said, well, that went so well. I was hoping it would. And if it went well, I was going to ask you to play on this cruise ship with me. And
really?
So we played a week. It was from New York to London. It was really wild. But they used to do this a lot. They still do it, but they used to do this jazz festival at sea over through the Atlantic. Anyway, that week of gigs went great. Then he said, I think we should make a record. And so step by step, I just was with him all the time. And as he would fashion new projects, I was involved. I was able to be involved in them. It was just kind of organically kept going. And then we worked a lot together. And it was
that your most formative young ensemble playing? Or did you have your own band when you were like 10 as well?
No, I never had my own band. The first person I ever, you can say, you know, it's not like discovered me, but the person who put a lot of stock in me, apart from my family and community, was David Grisman. David Grisman, I met at a guitar show. I would have been about 11. And I was, again, a kid playing guitar in a town. That was my whole, it wasn't like a, it just wasn't more than that to me, at least. And Dave was the, said, I'd like to record you. So he's the first person I recorded with, is a duet. We did a duet on a record called Dog Duos. And
that was your first recording experience?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow, that's cool. The first time I recorded. Yeah. It was great. But no, I didn't have a band. I mean, truth of the matter is, I'm such a nerd for this stuff. You know, I'm a student. So I think at that age, I was able to be, because I wasn't pursuing anything beyond learning, I was just a student. I just studied, read all the books I could, took all the lessons I could, and was surrounded by incredible kindness, you know, and nurturing energy. I mean, on a familial level and a community level. So I recognize that in today's world, that's, it's different. And I, you know, there was no YouTube when I was growing up. There was no, there's none of that. So I count my blessings that I didn't really have to do anything other than be in hiding and work hard. And Gary was a foil for me in the world, because I didn't make my first record until I was 21. So from five until 21, I was really just someone who studied and played gigs with people.
That's a long time. Yeah, that's cool.
A long time. Yes, you're just kind of working on it, you know. So anyway, that's it in a nutshell.
Wow. And the bluegrass thing for you, has that Mount Royal record you did with Critter, is, I love that record too. I saw you guys playing at the City Winery here. Is that have you always explored that a little bit, or like, what's your relationship with bluegrass?
Well, I love bluegrass. I'm far from a bluegrass player, but I love the music as a fan. Yeah. And growing up around Grisman, you know, I was more in dog music land than I was bluegrass. But, you know, I would go with David to go see Del McCurry when he's in town, or we'd go see, he'd take me to go see Bela and the bluegrass sessions when they'd come through town. So I was around it, but not like fully steeped in it by any stretch of the imagination. Playing with Critter, Chris Eldridge, who's such a master of that discipline, is wonderful. Cause again, like we spoke of earlier, that is the sound of our friendship. It's not because I'm a bluegrass guitar player or have any inspiration. So, but we find middle ground with song forms and, certain stylistic things that I do think lean more bluegrass, and frankly, just playing an acoustic guitar up to a single mic puts you in a different space than jazz guitar. And I think that gives the impression that there's a bias towards bluegrass.
Like, did you ever sit down and study Tony Rice stuff at all? Or was that never really part of your vocabulary?
Okay, no, cool. I would listen to Tony Rice records and love them, but I wasn't, I'm also, I wasn't ever, how do you say it? I wasn't terribly acquisitional, you know, when I was younger. I didn't hear something and go, I got to have it, which is weird. And looking back, because I think for a lot of students, that's exactly how you learn. You transcribe and you metabolize. And but I would hear Tony Rice and be like, that's so cool. And then the juice I'd get from just loving it would kind of fuel my studies of theory or, you know, jazz or whatever. But it's kind of like seeing, you know, a different medium of art and getting inspiration. I'm not a great mimic either. I think there are players, students, who can actually start to get into embodying a player's style. And I'm terrible at that. I can't, it's not even close. So, hence I think I just always had a very respectful, distant appreciation of bluegrass.
Right.
But like we spoke of very briefly earlier, I mean, bluegrass and bebop they're kind of developing around the same time in this country. So you see a lot of similarities, you know, as far as music that, you know, perpetual motion music that deals with harmony at a fast rate, short forms.
Yep.
It's not too hard to draw the parallels between maybe the studies I really was devoted to in jazz and what I see my friends in the bluegrass world really being devoted to there. But at the end of the day, brother, as you know very well, the guitar is a beautiful connector, and the guitar allows you to slip in between streams. Even when you have no business being in that stream, there's something kind of endearing about pick up a new guitar, it's gonna sound that way. It's like, whatever, I don't say that with any disrespect. I say with the utmost respect that I recognize when I'm a tourist and when I'm not. And I think with bluegrass I'm a tourist, but a very happy one.
Well said. So I know you got to go here. I'm fascinated with the fact that you're on Blue Note now. Is that something like going forward? Is that like a long-term thing that you foresee being a relationship? And
oh, I'd love to.
Was Don Was like a mentor to you in some way with like signing to the label and just being part of that history?
Oh, it's a huge honor. Don, I only met Don within the last 5 or so years, but we hit it off famously. And I'm a fan. I've been a fan of his for a long time. And I knew his children because they went to a jazz camp that I taught at West. So I was kind of privy to him. And anytime my friends of mine would be making records for Blue Note and Don was involved, I was like a fanboy. You know, I'd be like, what's Don like? They'd be like, oh, he's the greatest. You'll love him. So to sign with them, it came at a time where I was available to sign, leaving one label in search of another. And, you know, we've made, I guess, 3 or so going on our fourth record together. So it already feels like a long-term, you know, I feel like they've invested in me in a very sincere and impactful, profound way. I would love to keep going. I mean, what Don represents to the community is huge. He's someone who truly gets it and supports music. And he also has the responsibility of taking the label forward. And he does that very elegantly. And it's him in conjunction with his team, Justin, Rachel, this whole team that really day in, day out works to make that label as great as it is. And so, I'd be thrilled to keep going with them. It does feel like a healthy partnership. It seems that way. Yeah, what's not to like, you know?
Yeah, it's a great fit. Yeah. Well, listen, man, thank you so much for hanging
thank
out today
you.
And spending
oh,
the time.
It's a pleasure. I really appreciate you taking the time and such great questions and so much consideration is put into it. So thank you. I appreciate you.
Well, thanks.
What are those next to your Pro-X? Is that a speaker? Those black ones behind you? What is that?
Yeah, they're Atomics.
Those look like kind of old fashioned monitors.
They look like old Altecs. Yeah, it's this guy who he's from Detroit and he was building power supplies for consoles. And then he started building speakers and he died and left behind a finite amount of speakers. And these are some of them. But a lot of people around here have them. Vance Powell has a pair and Dan Auerbach has a pair. And they're just, they have a subwoofer on the back that fires backwards.
Interesting.
And so it's all sort of like a self-contained, very cool. They're the speakers I turn on when I'm tracking and everyone comes up to listen, the Atomics go on because it sounds
that's
huge
cool.
and like really 3D and loud and
totally. I love, because I have the same Pro-X, so I love that you have the others to go with it. I can dig.
I did a record with Lee Townsend in the 90s and he had these Pro-X, and ever since then I bought these like after working with him, and I've used them on every, they're the speakers that I trust.
Totally. Well, I know Bill still uses those, Prezel, for everything naturally as an extension of Lee. That's so cool. Okay. Yeah. It's my one nerdy question I had to ask you.
Listen,
thanks for taking this time though, really.
Yeah. Thank you, Julian. I appreciate it, man.
Best of luck. I'll see you around, huh?
Okay. I hope so.
Okay. Bye,
All
brother.
Right. Take care. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening, everybody. Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast is produced at the Henhouse Studio in East Nashville, Tennessee. Please remember to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist for Spotify and Apple Music at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thank you again to our sponsors this season, Union Tube and Transistor, Spectra in 1964, the Deering Banjo Company, Mule Resonator Guitars, and the Henhouse Hang. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. Over and out.